Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Glad to be here.
So, have you ever kept a fail-safe system in your life?
Oh, definitely.
Think about a spare tire sitting in the trunk of your car, or maybe an auxiliary generator wired to your house that you only ever think about when a massive storm knocks the grid offline.
Right, the things you hope you never actually have to use.
Exactly. We keep these things around, and we neatly categorize them in our minds as alternatives. They are Plan B. They're the metabolic detours we rely on only when Plan A completely falls apart.
And because they are just a fail-safe, we usually assume they're a little less efficient.
Yeah, the spare tire is one of those tiny donuts that you can't drive over 50 miles an hour on. The auxiliary generator is loud, it's expensive to run, and it barely keeps the refrigerator cold.
You're just trying to survive the storm.
Right. But what if you went to start your car one morning and realized that without that tiny, inefficient spare tire sitting quietly in the trunk, the main engine itself refused to turn over?
That would be a serious design flaw.
Right. What if the whole system actually depended on the auxiliary failsafe just to function on a normal Tuesday?
Welcome to this deep dive. I am incredibly glad you are joining us today because we are looking at a piece of research that asks exactly that question, but on a microscopic cellular level.
It's a profound shift, really.
It is. The big takeaway here isn't just about cellular machinery, it's a masterclass in metabolic flexibility. This idea that what we call inefficiency in biology is often the exact mechanism that buys a cell the time, the resilience, and the signaling power it needs to adapt and survive.
We have this bad habit in science of finding the most robust, high-yielding pathway in a cell and crowning it the main engine.
The star of the show. Exactly, and then we relegate everything else to a supporting role. When we label a pathway as a backup, we tend to stop looking at it as critically. We assume we understand its limitations. But biology doesn't build systems based on human engineering flowcharts.
Which brings us directly to our source material for today's deep dive. Today, we celebrate the work of the researchers at the University of Moncton, specifically their New Brunswick Center for Precision Medicine.
They've done some incredible work here.
They really have. We're looking at a 2026 biochemistry paper published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, by researchers Leah Herpe, Melanie Amineau, and Nicholas Pichot. The title of their brief report really lays down the gauntlet. It's called When Alternative Becomes Essential, the Role of Mitochondrial Glycerol 3 Phosphate Dehydrogenase.
That is a title that tells you exactly what paradigm they're coming for.
So here is the roadmap for our discussion. We're going to look at how these researchers took a cellular pathway that science has long dismissed as a mere secondary intake valve and proved that it is absolutely vital for survival.
We have dense bioenergetics, genetically modified fruit flies, and a paradox involving cellular damage.
Yes, and a fundamental overturning of how we think our cells manage their power grids.
Yeah.
To help unpack all of this, I have our resident expert here. Thank you for joining me to decode this.
Always happy to dive in. What makes this paper so compelling is that it forces us to reevaluate the foundational tenets of cellular respiration.
It takes us right back to biology 101.
It does. It takes us right to the core of what keeps an organism alive and shows us that the machinery is far more interconnected and, frankly, far more fragile in its dependencies than the classic textbook models suggest. I'm looking forward to getting into the weeds on this one.
Let's start by establishing the baseline. For anyone who follows molecular biology, we all know the standard model of oxidative phosphorylation.
Right, the powerhouse of the cell.
Exactly. The mitochondria handle the bulk of our energy production generating ATP, which is the currency the cell uses to do everything from firing a neuron to contracting a muscle fiber.
It's the fuel.
Right. And we know that this process is driven by the electron transport chain. Usually when we talk about the heavy lifting in that chain, we talk about complex way. It is the massive, incredibly efficient primary turbine of the system.
It is the undisputed workhorse under normal conditions. Just to visualize the architecture here for a second, the electron transport chain is a series of protein complexes embedded in the inner membrane of the mitochondria.
Okay.
As electrons, which are stripped from the food we consume, flow down this chain, their energy is used to pump protons across the membrane. This creates a massive electrochemical gradient.
Kind of like pumping water up into a reservoir behind a dam, right?
That's a great analogy, yeah. Eventually, those protons flow back down the gradient through a structure called ATP synthase, which literally physically spins and creates ATP.
It's basically a microscopic hydroelectric clamp.
Exactly. Now, complex I is the primary intake valve for those electrons. It takes them from a carrier molecule called NADH. And complex I is incredibly efficient at its job. Mm. When it feeds electrons into the chain, it pumps a large number of protons.
So you get a big payout.
Huge. The ultimate yield for the cell is about 2.5 molecules of ATP for every NADH molecule oxidized at complex I. Because of this high yield, it has historically been viewed as the essential core of the powerhouse.
Right. If you want maximum miles per gallon, you use complex I. But this paper takes aim at a different piece of machinery entirely. It focuses on the G3P shuttle, which usually gets relegated to the metabolic sidelines.
The spare tire.
The spare tire, yeah. Specifically, an enzyme called mitochondrial glycerol task 3 phosphate dehydrogenase. I'm just going to call it MTG3PDH for the rest of this deep dive, because that is a mouthful.
A wise choice. I think we'd both be tripping over that all day. And to understand why MTG3PDH is viewed as an auxiliary system, we have to look at where it is located and what problem it solves.
Let's get into the geography of the cell.
Right. So during glycolysis, which is the initial breakdown of glucose that happens out in the main fluid of the cell, the cytosol, the cell generates some NADH. But here is the architectural problem. The inner membrane of the mitochondria is completely impermeable to NADH.
Like a brick wall.
A totally impermeable lipid bilayer. The molecule simply cannot cross over to hand its electrons to complex I.
So the cell is this energy-rich molecule sitting outside the factory,
yeah.
But the doors are locked.
Precisely. The cell can't move the molecule, so it has to move the electrons. It uses shuttles.
Okay.
There is the malate aspartate shuttle, which is highly efficient and essentially gets those electrons to complex I indirectly. But then there is the G3P shuttle. In this system, an enzyme in the cytosol takes the electrons from NADH and uses them to convert a molecule into G3P.
And then that G3P travels.
Yeah, that G3P floats over to the outer surface of the inner mitochondrial membrane. And this is where our enzyme MTG3PDH is sitting.
Yeah.
It grabs the G3P, takes the electrons, and feeds them directly into the electron transport chain.
But it skips a step, right?
It completely bypasses complex I. It drops the electrons further down the line, feeding them into a different carrier called coenzyme Q, using FADH2 instead of NADH.
And because it bypasses that massive first step at complex, it misses out on all the proton pumping that complex I does.
Exactly. It's skipping the first major turbine in the dam. Because of that bypass, the energy yield is significantly lower. Instead of 2.5 ATP, MTG3PDH only yields about 1.5 ATP per cycle.
That's a substantial drop in metabolic efficiency, almost half.
It is.
Which naturally leads to a question that I think anyone looking at this from an evolutionary perspective would ask. Why even have a less efficient secondary intake? If the cell has the malate aspartate shuttle to get electrons efficiently to complex, why maintain this 1.5 ATP detour at all?
Right, why not just optimize?
Exactly. The traditional assumption was that it must be a failsafe. It's the spare tire you use when the main road is blocked.
That has been the prevailing dogma for decades. The assumption was that evolution favors maximum efficiency unless the organism is under duress. Science looked at MTG3PDH and saw a redundant safety net.
Just waiting on the bench.
Yeah, it was thought to be an alternative electron entry point that only ramps up when complex I fails or during extreme environmental stress.
What kind of stress?
For example, previous literature heavily documented this pathway becoming highly active in insects during extreme dietary shifts or when they are exposed to severe cold. Situations where the highly complex main engine might lose its structural flexibility or become saturated. Under normal, healthy conditions, it was assumed to be quietly idling in the background.
Okay, so that sets the stage for the energy production side.
Yeah.
We have the efficient main engine and the inefficient auxiliary detour. But we need to introduce the other major element of this deep dive, because energy production is only half the story.
Yeah, the chemistry side.
The other half involves reactive oxygen species, or ROS. And I want to pause here, because when you hear reactive oxygen species or free radicals, the cultural association is immediate.
Oh yeah, it's the ultimate wellness villain.
We've been told for decades by the health and wellness industry to aggressively fight free radicals. You know, we're supposed to eat blueberries, drink green tea, and take all these antioxidant supplements to neutralize them because they cause cellular aging and DNA damage and inflammation.
The rust on the machine.
Right. So if this enzyme, MTG3PDH, is a known producer of these dangerous free radicals, it seems like shutting it off would be a good thing. Why is the cell intentionally manufacturing a toxic byproduct?
You would think shutting it off would be beneficial based on that nutritional marketing, but the biological reality of ROS is vastly more complex than just saying free radicals are bad. We have to look at the chemistry of what is actually happening in the mitochondria.
Walk us through it.
So when you are moving electrons down a transport chain, especially when the final destination for those electrons is oxygen, which is incredibly electronegative and reactive things, do not always proceed flawlessly.
It's a high energy environment.
Exactly. Electrons can occasionally slip out of the transport chain complexes and bind directly with an oxygen molecule prematurely. When oxygen gets an extra unpaired electron, it becomes a superoxide radical.
And that's the dangerous part.
Highly dangerous. It's a volatile, chemically aggressive molecule. It desperately wants to steal an electron from whatever is nearby to stabilize itself, whether that is a lipid in the cell membrane, a structural protein, or a strand of DNA.
That theft is what we call oxidative damage.
Yes, exactly. And the paper notes that MTG3-PDH is one of the sites in the mitochondria known to produce these ROS. When it oxidizes FADH2 and passes those electrons into the chain, it can leak superoxide onto both sides of the inner mitochondrial membrane.
Okay, so it's a leaky valve?
It is, but the story gets much stranger. If MTG3-PDH is highly active, it is dumping electrons rapidly into the coenzyme Q pool, which is like a holding area in the middle of the transport chain.
Right.
If that pool gets saturated, you get a microscopic traffic jam. The system becomes hyper-reduced, and when the pressure builds up enough, the electrons can actually be forced to flow backward.
Okay, backward. Against the thermodynamic gradient.
It is entirely counterintuitive, but yes. It is a phenomenon called reverse electron transfer, or RET.
RET.
If the thermodynamic conditions are right, specifically if you have a high proton motive force and a highly saturated coenzyme Q pool, the electrons are forced upstream back into complex I. And when complex I is hit with electrons in reverse, it generates a massive explosive amount of superoxide.
Wow.
It is one of the highest known rates of ROS production in the entire cellular environment.
So historically you have this enzyme MTG3-PDH that produces significantly less energy than the main pathway, and it has the potential to trigger this backward flow that spews out damaging free radicals.
Yeah, it doesn't sound great on paper.
From a purely mechanistic standpoint, it is no wonder scientists assumed it was a pathway best kept suppressed unless absolutely necessary. It looks like a hazardous, inefficient detour.
But the nuance here is that not all ROS is a destructive fire. We have to reframe how we think about oxidative stress entirely. Because basal levels of ROS, the low, steady emission that happens during normal metabolism, aren't just harmless byproducts.
They are an essential communication network,
yeah.
Right?
It's a vital paradigm shift. Think of a low-level ROS emission not as a fire burning down the house, but as the house's smoke detector system.
Okay, I like that analogy.
The cell is a vast, complex environment. The nucleus, where the DNA resides, needs to know what is happening down in the mitochondrial power plants. But the mitochondria can't just send an email.
Right, they don't have a nervous system.
Exactly. They use ROS as the messenger. If the mitochondria are working at maximum capacity, or if they are beginning to suffer from wear and tear, they release a specific signature of hydrogen peroxide.
Which is different from superoxide.
Yes, superoxide is quickly converted into hydrogen peroxide because hydrogen peroxide is much more stable and can easily diffuse across membranes to carry the message. That ROS signature travels to the nucleus and triggers an alarm.
So the nucleus senses the oxidative stress and mounts a response.
Exactly, it triggers essential adaptive processes. If the ROS signal indicates moderate stress, it might trigger mitochondrial biogenesis.
Building new mitochondria.
Right, the cell will transcribe new genes to build fresh, healthy mitochondria to reinforce the grid. But if the ROS signal is overwhelmingly high, indicating catastrophic damage, it triggers apoptosis.
Programmed cell death.
Yes. The cell realizes it is too damaged to function safely, so it dismantles itself before it becomes necrotic or turns into a cancerous threat to the tissue.
So without that ROS signaling, the cell is functionally blind and deaf to its own metabolic state.
Entirely. It doesn't know when to adapt, when to repair, or when to initiate a controlled shutdown.
This sets up the central tension of the research beautifully. We have this auxiliary enzyme MTG3-PDH. It's less efficient at making ATP, and it's a major instigator of these ROS fire alarms, especially through that wild reverse electron transfer mechanism.
The dogma says it's a backup.
But the team at the University of Moncton suspected that this enzyme is doing something far more fundamental than just waiting on the bench. And to prove it, they took the classic genetic approach. They decided to surgically remove this one specific piece of machinery and observe the fallout.
It is the most direct way to interrogate a biological system. If you want to know what a gear does in a watch, you take it out and see how the watch fails.
They didn't do this in human cell cultures, though. They used Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly.
A classic model.
For anyone who might wonder why we are spending a deep dive talking about insect biology, it's worth noting that fruit flies are arguably the most powerful model organism in genetics. We share a massive amount of fundamental metabolic architecture with them. Their generation time is incredibly fast, and their genome is entirely mapped and easily manipulable.
They are the unsung heroes of genetic research.
Truly. And the researchers didn't just smash the GPO1 gene, which is the gene that codes for this enzyme, with a hammer. They used CRISPR-Cas9 to make a highly targeted surgical strike.
The precision of CRISPR here is what makes the resulting data so unassailable.
Walk us through what they actually did to the gene.
They created a specific mutant line called the GPO1 line. They didn't delete the entire gene, which could have unpredictable cascading effects. Instead, they inserted just 7 specific amino acids into the sequence.
Right, it's a microscopic edit, just a tiny insertion in a massive genetic code.
But proteins are all about shape. Form dictates function. By inserting those specific amino acids, they altered the folding of the MTG3-PDH protein just enough to completely destroy its enzymatic activity.
So it was still there, but it was broken.
Exactly. It could no longer bind to the membrane properly or transfer electrons. But the brilliance of the specific mutation is the control aspect. The G3P shuttle relies on 2 enzymes, the mitochondrial one we were discussing, and its partner enzyme out in the cytosol CG3-PDH.
Right, they work as a pair.
If the CRISPR edit had damaged both enzymes, the results would be muddy. You wouldn't know which loss was causing the phenotype. But this targeted insertion selectively killed the mitochondrial side of the shuttle while leaving the cytosolic partner perfectly healthy and abundant.
So they isolated the failure to the exact point of electron entry into the mitochondria.
Exactly. It's an incredibly clean experiment.
So they have these mutant flies living with a completely broken auxiliary power system. But they didn't just observe the whole fly. They zeroed in on the tissue where energy matters most. They extracted mitochondria specifically from the thoraxes of 10-day-old male flies. Why focus exclusively on the thorax?
Well, if you are investigating a potential energy crisis, you look at the tissue with the highest metabolic demand. In a human, you might look at the left ventricle of the heart or the cortex of the brain. In a fruit fly, the absolute pinnacle of energy consumption is the thorax.
Because of the wings.
Because that is where the flight muscles are located. Insect flight muscles are a marvel of bioengineering. They have to contract at astonishing speeds, hundreds of times per second, and to sustain that, the tissue is densely packed with incredibly active mitochondria.
But basically all engine in there.
It operates almost exclusively on oxidative phosphorylation. There is very little margin for metabolic error in flight muscle. If the loss of this supposedly redundant pathway is going to cause a systemic issue, it will manifest first and most violently in the thorax.
That brings us to the macro level results. Section 5 of our deep dive. What happens to a complex organism when you cut off this single inefficient detour? The survival data alone is staggering. The control group, the flies with a normal unedited genome, had a median lifespan of 33 days. The GPO1 mutants, lacking only this one enzyme, had a median lifespan of 12 days.
It is a precipitous drop. They lost nearly 2/3 of their expected lifespan.
Just from losing a backup pathway.
And the researchers ran robust statistical analyses on this. It wasn't a slight trend. It was a definitive, mathematically undeniable crash in viability.
Let me push back here for a second, just like devil's advocate. Whenever you use CRISPR to mutate a genome, there's always the risk of off-target effects. Or that the mutated protein itself becomes toxic and clumps up in the cell, poisoning the organism.
That's a very standard critique, yeah.
How do we know the flies didn't just die from some unintended toxicity rather than the specific loss of the energy pathway?
It is a vital question, and it's why the methodology matters so much. The researchers anticipated this. They confirmed that the mRNA expression for the gene was actually upregulated.
Meaning the cell was trying to make more of it.
Right. The cell realized the enzyme wasn't working and tried to compensate by making more, but the protein itself was enzymatically dead. Furthermore, they didn't see the markers of widespread non-specific protein toxicity.
So it wasn't a poison effect?
No, the failure was highly localized to the bioenergetic parameters they measured. The flies didn't die because of toxic sludge buildup. They died because their fundamental energy grid failed.
And we see that failure mapped out in their behavior long before they died. The researchers used a standard assay called the vial climbing test, or negative geotaxis.
It's a very common behavioral assay for flies.
It exploits the natural instinct of a fruit fly to climb upward when knocked to the bottom of a tube. You tap them down, start a timer for 30 seconds, and see how many make it to the top. It's a very clear proxy for locomotor function and overall systemic energy.
It tests their explosive energy reserves, basically.
Right. And in the normal flies, about 68.5% of them shot right to the top of the vial. In the mutants, only 1% managed to climb it. One single percent. The researchers described them as completely lethargic.
To contextualize that 1%, you have to imagine the physiological state of the organism. This isn't just fatigue. It isn't feeling a bit sluggish after a bad night's sleep. This is a profound, paralytic lack of cellular fuel.
Like running completely out of gas on the highway.
The nervous system might be sending the signal to the flight muscles to contract, but the ATP simply isn't there to execute the movement. They are trapped at the bottom of the vial by gravity because their cells cannot generate the energy required to overcome it.
That's brutal.
Right out of the gate, before we even look at the chemistry, this behavioral and survival data completely shatters the dogma. A system does not experience catastrophic, lethal failure when a backup goes offline. You only see a collapse like this when a primary load-bearing pillar is removed.
So they have a 60% drop in lifespan and near total loss of motor function. The organism is dying. But to prove why the researchers had to look under the hood, they had to look at the bioenergetics of those thorax mitochondria in real time. This is where the data directly confronts the established textbook models. You have the figures from the paper in front of you. How bad was the damage down at the molecular level when they cut the failsafe?
The biochemical assays reveal a system in total disarray. When they measured the overall ATP production, the actual volume of energy currency being manufactured by the mitochondria, it had plummeted by roughly 60% in the mutant flies compared to the controls.
More than half of their power generation just gone.
Exactly. But the critical piece of data is what happened to their oxygen consumption. Remember, in oxidative phosphorylation, oxygen is the final electron acceptor. It is the raw material being consumed to drive the process.
Right, you breathe in oxygen to feed this chain.
Yes. The oxygen consumption in the mutants did drop, but only by about 33%.
Okay, let's unpack those two numbers because they are disproportionate. A 60% drop in the final product, but only a 33% drop in the raw material consumption. It sounds like the factory didn't just slow down, it lost its pacing.
That is the perfect way to phrase it. In bioenergetics, we rely heavily on a metric called the ATP to O ratio. It measures the coupling efficiency of the mitochondria.
Coupling efficiency.
Yeah, how many molecules of ATP do you get for every atom of oxygen you consume? It is the cellular equivalent of miles per gallon. Because the ATP production crashed so much harder than the oxygen consumption, the ATP to O ratio of these mutant mitochondria was wrecked. They were uncoupled.
So the engine is running, but the car isn't moving.
The machinery was still burning through oxygen. Electrons were still flowing down the chain, but that flow was no longer translating effectively into the proton gradient required to spin the ATP synthase turbine. The system was spinning its wheels, generating heat and waste, but failing to capture the energy.
This is where things don't make intuitive sense to me.
Hmm.
If MTG3-PDH, the enzyme they knocked out, normally only contributes a small fraction of the total electron flow and only yields 1.5 ATP, how does losing it cause the entire factory to lose 60% of its output and become uncoupled?
It's the multi-million dollar question.
What exactly broke down in the assembly line? Did the loss of the auxiliary system somehow damage the main engine? Did complex I fail?
This is the exact question the researchers asked, and it leads to the most important bioenergetic finding of the study. They isolated complex I in these mutant mitochondria and tested its specific function. They measured its coupling efficiency and its capacity to pump protons.
And what did they find?
They found absolutely nothing wrong with it. Complex, I was completely unchanged. It was structurally sound, and when provided with substrate, it functioned just as efficiently as it did in the healthy flies. The main engine was perfectly fine.
That is wild. The primary turbine is sitting there fully functional, ready to work, but the system is collapsing around it.
It is the definitive aha moment of the paper. Decades of biochemical assumptions were based on the idea that complex I is the autonomous powerhouse, and MTG3-PDH is just a secondary intake that steps up if complex I falters. This data proves the inverse is also true, and perhaps more vital.
So they need each other.
Even with a perfectly healthy, completely intact complex I-main engine, the loss of the MTG3-PDH auxiliary pathway caused the entire mitochondrial grid to collapse. The main engine could not compensate for the loss of the detour, it could not pick up the slack or stabilize the ATP to O ratio.
It completely reframes how we think about metabolic flexibility. We assume flexibility means if pathway A fails, use pathway B. But this implies that pathway A actually requires pathway B to be running in the background just to maintain the stability of the whole network.
Precisely. It proves that MTG3-PDH is not an alternative. It is an essential load-bearing component of the bioenergetic grid. It regulates the flow. Without it, the structural integrity of the entire electron transport process degrades regardless of how robust complex I is.
That's a massive shift in understanding. But we aren't done because the energy deficit is only one half of the paradox here. We have to bring ROS back into the conversation.
The other side of the coin.
If we accept that the mutant flies are dying because their energy grid collapsed, we still have to look at the oxidative stress data. Earlier, we established that MTG3-PDH is a massive producer of ROS, both by leaking superoxide directly and by triggering that backward flow, the reverse electron transfer into complex I.
The fire alarm system we talked about.
Right, so logically, if you delete the enzyme responsible for this massive ROS production, the mutant flies should be experiencing significantly less oxidative stress. They should have less cellular damage.
And that is exactly what the data showed. The researchers measured the emission of hydrogen peroxide, which, as we discussed, is the stable proxy used to measure overall ROS production.
Yeah.
And the drop was dramatic. The mutant flies were producing about 70% less ROS than the control flies.
A 70% reduction. If you could bottle that effect into a pill, the anti-aging industry would be throwing billions of dollars at you. You have an organism experiencing almost zero oxidative damage.
The drop in ROS was highly specific too. The researchers traced it back to the exact sites. The ROS emission at the MTG3-PDH location vanished, obviously, because the enzyme was dead. But more importantly, the ROS emission at complex I also plummeted.
Because without MTG3-PDH pumping electrons into the middle of the chain, that traffic jam in the coenzyme Q pool never happened. The reverse electron transfer stopped.
Exactly. The retrograde flow was cut off, so the entire mitochondrial system went quiet in terms of oxidative stress. The cells were essentially shielded from free radical damage.
So I am stuck on something. If they drop the ROS by 70% in tritians, their cells are pristine. Why are we sure the flies didn't die simply from the 60% energy crash? Why does the lack of ROS matter if they're already starving for ATP? This is the ROS paradox. How do we solve it?
We solve it by looking at the systemic response to starvation. If a cell experiences a 60% drop in ATP, it shouldn't just passively die, it should fight back.
It should try to survive.
Exactly. It should trigger metabolic adaptations. It could upregulate other pathways or initiate mitochondrial biogenesis to build more power plants to make up for the deficit. But these mutant flies didn't adapt. They just rapidly declined and died in 12 days. Why?
They didn't know they were starving.
Exactly. This brings us back to the smoke detector analogy. By knocking out MTG3-PDH, the researchers didn't just turn off an inefficient energy generator. They physically cut the wires to the cellular fire alarm system.
Oh, wow. Because that massive burst of ROS from the reverse electron transfer wasn't just accidental damage. It was the specific signal the mitochondria needed to send.
Yes. That specific high-intensity ROS pulse is a crucial retrograde signal. It tells the nucleus, we are in crisis down here, we need reinforcements.
So the mutant cells were experiencing a catastrophic energy collapse. Their ATP was plummeting, and their coupling efficiency was wrecked.
But because MTG3-PDH was dead, and the RET pathway was blocked, the mitochondria could not generate the ROS signal to warn the nucleus. The alarm never sounded.
The larger cell was completely ignorant of the crisis happening inside its own organelles.
It received no signals to initiate repairs, no signals to build new mitochondria, and no signals to trigger apoptosis to safely clear out the failing structures. The lack of ROS didn't save them from oxidative damage. It condemned them to a silent, rapid death because they lost their absolute fundamental ability to communicate and adapt.
That is chilling, honestly. The very mechanism that we view as toxic, the backward flow of electrons creating oxidative stress, is the exact same mechanism keeping the survival protocols online. You can't just turn off the stress without turning off the resilience.
You lose the bad, but you also lose the vital.
This paper is a monumental paradigm shift. It completely dismantles the hierarchy of the electron transport chain. We can no longer view complex ACE as the king and MTG3-PDH as the peasant backup.
It forces a complete rewrite of textbook biochemistry. The paper proves that MTG3-PDH operates at the nexus of bioenergetics and redox signaling. It engages multiple pathways simultaneously. It provides a baseline of energy, yes, but its true value is in regulating the flow, intentionally creating the thermodynamic traffic jams necessary for signaling and balancing the entire redox state of the cell.
Is a master regulator disguised as a failsafe?
Perfectly said.
I want to pivot here because while the biochemistry of a fruit fly thorax is endlessly fascinating, I want to make sure you listening understand the broader implications. We aren't just talking about why a fly can't climb a vial. We're talking about highly conserved evolutionary pathways. This fundamental metabolic architecture exists in us.
Humans rely on these exact same systems.
Right. How does understanding MTG3-PDH as an essential keystone rather than a disposable alternative change how we view human health and disease?
The implications are massive, and the paper explicitly connects these findings to severe human pathologies. When this exact same enzyme dysfunctions in a human body, it doesn't just cause lethargy. It is deeply implicated in life-threatening conditions.
What kind of conditions?
Let's look at the metabolic diseases first. The paper cites ongoing research into lipotoxic cardiomyopathy.
Lipotoxic cardiomyopathy, that's a mouthful.
It is. It's a severe condition where the heart muscle, which like the fly thorax, has immense energy demands and relies heavily on mitochondrial oxidation, begins to accumulate toxic lipid intermediates.
So the heart is essentially suffocating in unprocessed fats.
In a sense, yes. The heart prefers to burn fatty acids for fuel. But if the metabolic pathways become bottlenecked, these lipid intermediates build up and cause severe cellular damage, leading to heart failure.
And where does our enzyme sit in?
Research is increasingly pointing to MTG3-PDH as a critical relief valve in this process. It helps balance the redox state, the ratio of NADH to NAD, plus in the cytosol, allowing lipid metabolism to proceed smoothly. If this alternative pathway is impaired, the heart loses its metabolic flexibility, the lipids accumulate, and the tissue fails.
It's the same principle as the fly. If you lose the detour, the main highway backs up and the whole system crashes.
Exactly right.
What about cancer? Because anytime we talk about cellular metabolism, the Warburg effect and cancer biology usually enter the chat. Cancer cells famously alter their metabolism to survive and proliferate in environments that would kill a normal cell.
Cancer is perhaps the most critical area of research involving MTG3-PDH right now. Tumors exist in highly stressful microenvironments. They are often starved of oxygen and nutrients. To survive, they aggressively rewire their metabolic grid.
So they would rely on this alternative pathway.
The paper references recent studies showing that certain cancer cells heavily upregulate MTG3-PDH. They don't do this primarily for the ATP, they do it for the signaling and the redox balance.
They hijack the cellular smoke detector.
Exactly. But they also use it as a shield. And this brings us to a concept called ferroptosis.
Ferroptosis, that is a relatively new term in the biology zeitgeist, right? It was only characterized around 2012, I think. We all know apoptosis is programmed cell death, but what exactly is ferroptosis?
Apoptosis is clean and orderly. The cell neatly packages itself up and is consumed by immune cells without causing inflammation. Ferroptosis is entirely different. It is a form of regulated cell death that is driven by iron-dependent lipid peroxidation.
Lipid peroxidation.
Essentially, if the lipids in the cell membrane become overly oxidized, if they get too rusty from free radicals, and there is iron present to catalyze the reaction, it triggers a catastrophic chain reaction that literally shatters the cell membrane. It is a highly inflammatory, violent form of cell death.
And how does MTG3-PDH protect against that?
Recent studies, which the Moncton researchers highlight, show that MTG3-PDH acts as a critical defense mechanism against ferroptosis in certain mitochondria. By modulating the flow of electrons and regulating the specific types of ROS being produced, it prevents the massive lipid peroxidation required to trigger ferroptosis.
Wow, so the cancer cells figure this out.
They upregulate MTG3-PDH to act as an armor against ferroptosis, allowing the tumor to survive under extreme oxidative stress that would otherwise tear a healthy cell apart.
So if a pharmaceutical company is trying to design a drug to kill a tumor, and they look at a textbook that says MTG3-PDH is just a secondary, unimportant backup pathway, they might ignore it entirely.
They'd overlook the exact thing keeping the tumor alive.
But this research says no, this enzyme is the shield keeping the cancer intact. If you target the backup, you might actually induce ferroptosis and kill the tumor.
Exactly. You don't try to fix or dismantle a complex machine if you think half the parts are just optional accessories. You have to understand how every gear relies on the others. This paper provides the foundational proof that targeting these auxiliary pathways can cause systemic lethal collapse.
That is a terrifying prospect for the mutant fruit fly, but it is an incredibly promising vulnerability to exploit in cancer therapeutics.
It really is. It opens up entirely new avenues for targeted treatments.
It is a profound lesson in biological humility. We look at systems through the lens of industrial efficiency. We see a 1.5 ATP yield compared to a 2.5 ATP yield, and we instinctively label the lower number as inferior as a fallback option.
Because we think like engineers, not like nature.
Right. But the cell isn't just optimizing for maximum power output. It is optimizing for survival in a chaotic environment. It looked at that 1.5 ATP yield, combines it with the ability to balance the cytosolic redox state, and pairs it with the capacity to intentionally trigger a highly specific ROS signaling pulse through reverse electron transfer. And the cell concludes that is the perfect necessary balance to keep this organism alive and adaptable.
It truly reminds us that efficiency in a complex biological network is rarely just a measure of maximum throughput. Real efficiency is a measure of resilience, communication, and homeostasis.
I love that.
Think of it this way. A bridge isn't just about the main suspension cables. It's about the countless smaller tension wires that absorb the wind and the vibrations. Remove the minor wires and the main cables eventually snap under the unmitigated stress.
That is a perfect analogy. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the physics of electron flow to the violent death of cancer cells. Let me try to synthesize this into a final punchy takeaway for you listening.
Let's hear it.
For decades, the standard biological model labeled a cellular pathway called the G3P shuttle, and specifically its mitochondrial enzyme as a mere backup generator. It was viewed as an inefficient detour, mostly known for occasionally leaking dangerous free radicals. But an elegant study using CRISPR to selectively knock out this exact pathway in food flies proved the dogma completely wrong.
Utterly dismantled it.
When the failsafe was removed, the primary engine complex, I stayed perfectly healthy, but the entire bioenergetic grid collapsed anyway. The flies suffered a 60% drop in energy production, lost all motor function, and saw their lifespans plummet by nearly 2/3. Furthermore, shutting down this supposedly toxic pathway actually silenced the cell's vital ROS communication system, blinding the nucleus to the crisis and preventing any chance of cellular repair.
A silent death.
The conclusion is absolute. MTG3PDH is not an alternative. It is an essential load-bearing keystone that maintains the stability, the signaling, and the life of the organism.
It is a brilliant, rigorous piece of science, and I think it leaves us with something deeply philosophical to consider. If the biological machinery of these flies, and by extension our own human bodies, absolutely requires these seemingly inefficient ROS-producing flawed pathways just to maintain structural integrity and communicate properly, it demands that we look inward.
In what way?
What other perceived flaws, inefficiencies, or backups in human biology are we trying to medicate away or suppress simply because we don't understand that they are the hidden keystones keeping our metabolism balanced right now? How much of our own biological resilience do we actively undermine simply because we've mislabeled it as pathology?
That is a phenomenal question and exactly the kind of thought I want you to carry with you today. Take a closer look at the inefficiencies and the failsafes in your own life and maybe give them the respect they clearly deserve. They might be the only things holding the main engine together.
It's been a great discussion.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, bit by bit. Where it used to flow.
harsh light dimmed to calm. Fewer little storms of damage, fewer reasons for alarm. Not a cure, not a sermon, just a map of what is true. If you chase the spark too hard, it might be chasing you. When the backup turns aside,